Made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Vision to Verse, Verse to Vision, a visual and poetic dialogue, paintings by Jessica Damon and poetry by Maj Regain. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines, at 11 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Animal behavior is in part hardwired, but animals also learn. Learning, says biologist Susan McCarthy, connects heredity and environment. She says it's the ultimate combination of nature and nurture. Susan McCarthy, the co-author of When Elephants Weep, is our guest this afternoon. Her latest book is Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Learn to Live in the Wild. Let me share with you what Susan has to say at the outset of her book, Becoming a Tiger. Somehow, a fuzzy, stumbling tiger kitten becomes a monstrously efficient killer. Somehow, a big-footed fool of a raven fledgling becomes an aerial acrobat and a masterful survivor in the Northwoods. Somehow, a wide-eyed, spindle-limbed squirrel monkey infant becomes a wily adult who eats a wholesome caterpillar and avoids a poisonous one. Somehow, a panda finds love, a spear-nosed bat joins a sorority, and a bear who successfully holds a territory passes her hard-won gains onto her ignorant cubs. That's from the outset of Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Learn to Live in the Wild. Listeners, I invite your questions about animals and learning. Join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a bit more about our guest, Susan McCarthy. She has earned degrees in biology and journalism. She writes regularly for Salon.com and has contributed to Best American Science Writing. Her new book, Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Learn to Live in the Wild, is published by HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Susan McCarthy, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. You know, the planet teems with animal life. Do we all learn?
Pretty much. Even animals where almost everything that they know, they're born knowing it, have to learn local details. They have to learn their neighborhood. They have to learn where the food is.
Mm-hmm.
Really basic stuff. But then more complicated animals have a whole lot to learn.
Yeah. Well, humans have to learn a lot. You know, when I think about it, you know, how much is instinctual to us? Are other animals as helpless as we are at birth?
Some of them are. The animals that have to learn the most seem to be mostly either animals that are generalists, that live in all kinds of environment and eat all kinds of foods, and that's us, but we're not the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in birds, the jays and crows and ravens are generalists. You find them in a lot of different environments, eating all kinds of foods. And for birds, they seem to be really smart. Other animals that have to learn a lot are animals with complicated social lives, because you have to learn who's your friend, you have to learn who's not your friend, you have to learn how to act so that you don't make other creatures mad at you. And so that applies to animals like wolves and elephants and dolphins, which all live socially and have to learn to negotiate the social shoals. And then there are a few weird exceptions like octopuses, which they're not social at all and they don't live very long, but they have very complicated bodies and they go through different life stages. And maybe that's why for invertebrates they do a lot of learning.
Hmm. Interesting. Tell us about the rabbit and the zigzag. This is a behavior that's not learned, and for an animal that's short-lived, it's very important.
Well, that's right. If you've ever been driving down maybe a country road and a rabbit jumps out in the road in front of you, and instead of scooting across the road and getting out of the way, you'll see it, oftentimes you'll see it run down the road in front of you in a zigzag. So it isn't even covering very much ground, and it puts it at considerable risk of being squashed by your car. But this is an innate, inborn predator avoidance technique. And if the rabbit, if an eagle swoops down on a rabbit, and the rabbit zigzags like this, there's a very good chance that it can get away from the eagle because the eagle can't maneuver as quickly as the rabbit. It works great with bobcats and coyotes and other predators, but it doesn't work so well against cars.
Yeah.
Now, the reason that rabbits have this hardwired is because they would probably die in the process of learning it at such a great rate. So, you know, you look at a rabbit and you think, you know, that rabbit... it's born knowing everything it needs to know. It doesn't need to learn anything. But the fact is that rabbits do learn things, and one of the interesting things they learn is they learn to understand the alarm calls of other species. There was a zoologist, Maurice Burton, who adopted a wild baby rabbit right out of the nest when its eyes were still closed. And his neighbor also raised a baby rabbit that he found when it was several weeks old. And Burton's rabbit, when it heard a bird's alarm call, maybe a starling alarm call,
mm-hmm.
it would just continue to sit there scratching its ears and being happy. And his neighbor's rabbit, who had been adopted at an older age, would freeze. And the reason was that the older rabbit had seen its parents freeze when they heard an alarm call, so it knew that was something to be scared about, whereas Burton and his family didn't freeze when they heard a starling alarm call.
Very interesting. We already have a listener waiting to talk with us, so let's go and take a call. A caller in Indiana on the toll-free line, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes, there's two questions, and the first one is exactly about what you're talking about now, since the quote-unquote hard wiring. There's people claim the same things occurs in human growth, and I was wondering if there's any general principle in the different groups that the zoologists and biologists have checked to see if it's like the first, you know, 1% of normal life or the first 0.5%, or is it just particularly age-related or whatever. And the second question is something that was sort of where I'm from here in Indiana is almost apocryphal. Every generation hears it, and I've actually seen it happen. And that's the animal that was left out 100, you know, pick a number, and returns home by itself, presumably. And
mm-hmm.
I saw a dog do this one time in a small community where I lived, and I remember I used to ask a lot of questions in school, and no one would really give me good answers. The usual thing was, well, he was picked up by a car and dropped off the edge of the town, and he knew they recognized the area, and that's how it happened. I just wonder if you'd have any, you know, anything about that. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well... Let's do the second question first, because that's interesting. You know, a lot of animals, there is some theory about this. A lot of animals are born with essentially the equivalent of a compass. But a compass isn't any good to you if you don't have a map. I mean, you could say, I know I need to go north, but north from where? So oftentimes in life, animals that migrate, for example, they have some inborn abilities, but they also need to learn. And this has been demonstrated by people who raised birds in planetariums with weird star maps. And so when the birds grew up, they migrated in the wrong direction because they had learned that the stars were at different compass points than they really were. Now, you know, how does that apply to a dog? Well, the dog may know general directions. If it's far enough away, it's not going to recognize any landmarks. It could recognize smells that we can't even detect. And so it could, as it gets closer to home, the smells could smell more familiar. I know that when I was away at college, my dog started to get excited, maybe 15 miles away from home in areas where she really shouldn't be able to recognize any physical landmarks marks by eye or ear, but I think she was getting excited because it smelled more and more like home as we got closer. Now, I think that if you had a certain number of lost dogs, some of them, that wouldn't be good enough, and they wouldn't make it home, but we certainly notice the ones who do make it home. As far as the first question about comparing humans to other animals and whether the hardwired things are in a certain percentage of their early life, I think that's really variable from animal to animal, because some animals really have to be independent from a very early age, and other animals like us that are protected by their parents for long periods of time have the luxury of learning things, and the more things that you're able to learn, the less things have to be hardwired in the genes.
Very interesting. Susan McCarthy, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about animals and learning. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Does learning require thinking?
Well,
yes and no.
Some of it does, and some of it doesn't. You know, I was wondering about that, actually, and there's animal trainers notice this thing called the pre-learning dip, and this is sort of frustrating for an animal trainer. Karen Pryor, who's a wonderful animal trainer, has written about this. You're training the animal to do something when you give the signal, and the animal is getting better and better and better, and then all of a sudden the animal does really badly, and this is the pre-learning dip, where all of a sudden it's doing the wrong thing at the wrong time, and it's doing weird stuff, and then all of a sudden the animal does it perfectly. And the way she perceives this is that initially the animal is learning, you know, to do something, to sit or to bark or to come or to fetch, but it doesn't really understand the connection. And at the point of the pre-learning dip, the animal suddenly thinks, wait a minute, she's raising her hand. That's a signal. What am I supposed to do with this signal? And then it figures it out. Oh, that's a signal that I'm supposed to walk across the room and lie down. Got it. And so at the end of the pre-learning dip, the animal now understands what you've trained it to do. Now, you can train the animal to do something, and it never understands, and it kind of does it unconsciously. And then there's the period when it has comprehension. And I've asked people if they can think of any examples of this happening to them, because it seems like a familiar phenomenon to me, where you're doing something and all of a sudden you realize why. And all the examples that people give me are word examples. They suddenly say, oh, I suddenly realized after using the phrase for years what holier-than-thou means, or how we, you know, they suddenly realize the etymology of a word.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a story, one of the wonderful stories in the book, Becoming a Tiger, is about a fox named Prince. And he figured out, someone was watching him, a human observer watching him. Prince figured out how to have a good time on an icy pond. And, you know, it led me to wonder, do animals have moments of eureka? And can there be, at some level, an awareness of learning?
I think they definitely have eureka moments, and it's lovely to watch them. Sue Savage Rumbaugh, who's a primatologist at Emory, has done some really fascinating work with chimpanzees and bonobos, the so-called pygmy chimpanzees, teaching them to understand symbols. But at one point in her research, she was working with an anthropologist or archaeologist, and they wanted to see if Kanzi could learn to flake flint the way primitive humans did. And so they set up this situation where Kanzi had flint, and they had a box with a transparent box that was fastened with rope. And inside the box was something that Kanzi wanted. And the only way he could get the box open, since it was tied up with rope, would be to hit two rocks together, flake off a sharp flake of flint, just like the kind that prehistoric humans used, cut the rope with the flint, and then he could open the box and get the prize or reward. And they demonstrated it so that he could see how it was done. And Kanzi understood that there was a good thing in the box, and he understood about cutting the rope with the flint. He could do that really easily. But and he understood what he was supposed to do, banging two rocks together to get the sharp flake of flint, but maybe because his hands weren't built like ours, he had a really hard time getting a flake of flint that was big enough. And one day he'd been trying, and he was kind of frustrated, and he was asking his human friends to do it for him, and they wouldn't. And he was sitting there holding this piece of flint in his hand, kind of dejected. And all of a sudden, eureka! He stood up, he threw the piece of flint at the floor as hard as he could. It shattered, and he picked up a piece of flint and used it to cut the rope and get the reward. And they thought, well, we don't think that prehistoric humans did that. So before his next session, they covered the floor with carpet. So Kanzi comes in, he sees the box with the rope around it and the flint. He throws the flint at the floor because he figures he's solved this problem, and it just bounces on the rug. And so he goes over the rug very carefully. I gather this was like indoor-outdoor carpeting. He finds a join. He peels the carpet back to find a place where there's hard floor. He bangs the flint on the hard floor, gets a flake, cuts the rope, gets the reward. And she has made a film of this whole process. They were hoping to show how a bonobo learns to flake flint just like a prehistoric human. And at the moment when Kanzi peels back the rope, peels back the rug and breaks the flint and gets the prize, the audience always breaks into cheers because we're rooting for him.
Yeah, well, we're there. I mean, we know what it's like, right? Maybe it's not, you know, cutting a piece of whatever to get a treat, but we know that we've had those frustrations, and finally, hooray!
Yeah, the moment of intellectual joy. Yeah, I get it.
Why has Mother Nature provided us with the need and the ability to learn?
Well, the environment is always changing, for one thing, and what works for a species one year or one day may not work the next, and other species are also evolving all the time. So just when you think that your species has worked out a good way to make a living, the rabbits learn to run faster, the turtles grow shells, the plants get spines on them. So the world is always changing, and animals have to be able to change to keep up with the rest of the world. And learning is much, much faster than waiting for evolution to handle things. The other thing is that when species are changing, there's an interesting phenomenon. Actually, I find it fascinating, called imprinting, in which the baby animal learns what its parents look like. And if species are evolving, then if you had an inborn, hardwired vision of what your parents look like instead of learning it, and then your parents didn't look like that, that would be pretty sad. I mean, if we all thought that our parents ought to look like tree shrews, who were the ancestors of primates, and then we looked into our parents' faces when we were born and thought, that's not a tree shrew, that would be a problem. So it's better that we learn what we look like.
Yeah. Well, one of the chapters in Becoming a Tiger is about the importance of learning to recognize your own species, and you say it's dismaying to think you could screw this one up. What can go wrong, and how do animals learn? How does an animal learn what it is and isn't?
Well, they mostly learn, usually they learn when they're very young. That is to say, sometimes animals learn even before they're born their parents' voices. Ducks and all kinds of birds peep and chirp to their eggs, and the little chicks within the egg chirp back. And so when they're born, they recognize their parents' voices. Other animals just gradually learn as they're born and their eyes open and so forth. Some birds don't learn until right about the time that they leave the nest. And it's very important, because if you don't know what your right species is, then when it becomes time to set up your own family, you could be going to the wrong place. And one of my favorite examples comes from a Journal of Wildlife Rehabilitation. Kay McKeever wrote this piece about how to prepare great horned owls that have been orphaned and raised by rehabbers to make their way in the wild once they're released adults. And part of her program is teaching them how to catch mice, and part of her program is to have them know that they're great horned owls, because it turns out that if you raise a great horned owl and it only sees people, and people feed it, and people take care of it, and then you let it go and it makes its living in the forest, then when it's time for romance, it's going to look for a human. Or specifically, since humans are so big, it's going to look for a human head, and because that's what it falls in love with. So If you're walking through the woods and this great horned owl starts swooping at you and hooting, you may not realize that the great horned owl is in love with you, or maybe mm-hmm. it's in love with your head, and it would like to settle down with your head and raise a family. And oftentimes these owls get into a lot of trouble because people think they're being attacked. So she says that when you are raising great horned owl orphans, you have to be careful not to let them see you. And ideally, they should be able to see another great horned owl, even if it's not taking care of them. If they can just see another great horned owl in the next cage and they don't see humans, then when they grow up, they will fall in love with the great horned owl instead of a human head.
Yeah. Well, you know, I interviewed some time ago an ornithologist who works with parrots, and she has a pet parrot, and the parrot thinks that they should be mates, mm-hmm. and this gets in the way of, you know, her relationship with her husband. The bird is jealous, and also the bird is continuing to build nests at certain points in the year throughout the house.
Well, see, this is one of the reasons why parrots can make such fantastic pets, is because they really are very ready to fall in love with humans, and they are ready to have a very close monogamous relationship. Of course, the problem is that they are jealous and possessive. And so if you live with other people, the parrot views them as being big troublemakers and would like them to leave. Many years ago, when there were almost no giant pandas outside of China, the London Zoo had a female giant panda, Chi-Chi, and the Moscow Zoo had a male giant panda, An-An, and the zookeepers were just determined that, you know, the only single female panda and the only single male panda outside of China should get together. And it took them years to arrange this, and I think the diplomats were really kind of baffled by the zookeeper's persistence. But they finally arranged for Chi-Chi and An-An to get together. An-An was flown from Moscow to London. And when Chi-Chi went into heat, An-An had the idea. And he was looking through the bars and bleeding hopefully. And Chi-Chi didn't like him. And they let him in the cage with her. And every time he got near her, she would belt him one. But she was in heat, and she wanted something, and after a few days, you know, An-An is following her around, and she's hitting him every time he gets mm-hmm. close. She finally got the idea that maybe it was time for her to mate with someone who loved and understood her, specifically a zookeeper. And so every time An-An would try to get friendly with her, she would hustle over and make advances to the zookeepers, and they were just beside themselves.
Yeah.
I'm not the guy for you.
Oh, man. Unrequited love.
And this is probably because Chi-Chi was raised by humans. She, you know, just hadn't seen pandas when she was young and probably didn't think of herself as a panda. She thought of herself as a human.
Yeah. Well, this gets at something else I want to ask you about. You know, as humans, we like to think of ourselves as lifelong learners. Although we know it's harder to, for example, learn a language, or it can be more challenging to learn to play a musical instrument, for example, as adults. But this is something that's really critical, isn't it, in the animal kingdom, the animal kingdom other than human animals?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some things that you are never too old to learn. You're absolutely right about languages and musical instruments, how those get harder to learn with time. You're never too old to learn that a certain food will make you sick. You're never too old to learn that you don't like somebody. There are certain, you know, really important basic facts that You could be tottering on the verge of senescence, and you think, you know, I don't like her, and I don't like that casserole. No, never again.
Yeah.
And you do see animals that continue to learn throughout life. There's a wonderful book, very obscure book, by a woman who adopted an orphan starling, house sparrow, during World War II, and Clarence, and he was slightly crippled, so she could never release him. And she taught him to do a bunch of tricks to entertain people who were shut up during the Blitz, and then stopped doing that after World War II was over. And she kept him alive to a fantastic old age for a sparrow. He lived to be 12, but when he was very old, he had a stroke. He couldn't hop anymore. He couldn't climb up. If he fell over, which he often did because his wing was now messed up, he couldn't scramble off his back. And he learned that if he fell on his back and couldn't scramble up, he could flip a somersault and get back on his feet. And when he couldn't hop along as sparrows did, he learned to walk one foot in front of the other just the way humans do, which is unheard of for a sparrow. And also when he was very old, she suddenly realized that she had never documented his little comedy act that she had put on for people during the Blitz. And she got a photographer to come over, and even though he hadn't done it in 6 years, he did it perfectly. So even though he was far older than house sparrows ever lived to be in the wild, he remembered stuff that he had learned long ago, and he was able to learn new skills to adapt to his age-related handicaps.
Yeah. You know, a few weeks ago, I talked with a man who had something similar happen to him. He found himself caring for a sparrow from the time the sparrow was, you know, not even, I don't think the sparrow had even fledged. And the sparrow played games with him. He could tell the sparrow, go get the blue bottle cap.
Uh-huh.
And the sparrow would do it. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think a lot of the animals, both pets and animals that aren't usually pets like the sparrow but are kept as pets, a lot of times we make claims for them that are just silly, and a lot of times we make claims for them that get dismissed as being silly but that are actually pretty legitimate. You know, there was a story in the paper a couple of weeks ago about a border collie that scientists had studied, and it knew the names of dozens and dozens of objects, and if it was given two familiar objects and one new one, it could deduce the name of the new one because it wasn't one of the old ones. And I think that lots of us have dogs that are that smart, and sometimes we even tell people that our dogs are that smart, but because we're not scientists and we haven't tested it in a scientific protocol, we don't get much respect.
Yeah. Well, growing up, we had a dog that learned how to enjoy a candy cane on the Christmas tree without pulling the tree over. And she would very patiently sit next to the candy cane, and she would suck on the candy cane, and the stripes would go away, and eventually the candy cane came to a point, and all the candy canes on the lower part of the tree were half eaten away or were in process, you know. Which was
kind of smart and tactful.
Yes. And she was also an animal that my mother would send to wake us up in the morning individually, you know.
Uh-huh.
Go get Celeste, and she would come and get me, and then the next one up would be. And of course, it never failed to get us up, because how would she get us up? She'd come in to the bedroom and give us a big slurp right across the face. Well, that'll get your attention.
Yeah, it will.
And you'll get up. We're talking this afternoon about animals and learning. Susan McCarthy is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Learn to Live in the Wild. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333, the number 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've got a call coming in. Before we do that, though, there was an interesting story. We talked about the starling. The bird named Scarlett O'Hara. Do you recall this? What a wonderful story.
That's a great story. She was acquired by the Hancocks, who were filmmakers, and also Lynn Hancock wrote books about their work. As an adult macaw, she'd been in a small cage for years, and either she probably had never learned to fly, but she was a magnificent bird who had a large vocabulary, most of it in a very refined British accent, and they really wanted, there was nothing wrong with her, her wings weren't clipped, they really wanted her to be able to fly. She didn't have the strength or any interest in taking off. So David Hancock would take her in his arms, he would throw her up into the air, and she would flap her wings and gradually come down to the ground, and she liked this very much. So she would waddle over to him and climb back up his leg to be thrown into the air again and again and again. And one day they were doing this, and she'd been practicing. She was getting her wing muscles back. She got a little altitude. Maybe she caught a little thermal, and she was going up quite high, just enjoying herself enormously, turned inexpertly into the wind, because birds know how to flap their wings. That's one of the hardwired things. But they don't know how to navigate winds. And she turned downwind. The wind started hurling her through the air. She was headed right for a swing set, and they were just, you know, afraid they would see disaster. At the critical moment, she folded her wings and shot through the chains of the swings without touching them, which was a triumph. And then she crash-landed in a big heap of bushes, and they knew she would be embarrassed. So they went in the house so that they wouldn't be watching her scramble out of the thicket. She climbed slowly out of the bushes, waddled over to the house, knocked on the front door with her beak, and said what you say when people knock on the front door. She said, "Come in." But it was just so wonderful for her to be able to learn to fly after all these years in a cage.
Yeah. Let's talk with some listeners. Let's go first to a caller in Danville on line 4. Hi.
Hello. I had an inexplicable behavior of a dog that we had. We've wondered about for 60 years, but we lived in Madison, Wisconsin, in a suburb that was hilly, and to get to our street, there was a block-long hill or hilly street to get there, and we had about a 4-year-old terrier mix who just went bananas and went out into the hall and cavorted and pranced around when my dad was coming home. And even before we could see or hear the car, why the dog would do that. And we decided, well, it must have been something inimical to the engine sound as it climbed the hill, and because he didn't do it with our other neighbors' cars. Well, one day, my dad went down to the district office in Chicago, and he was to come home that evening with a new car. And wintertime, a real blizzard came up, and my mother certainly did not expect my dad to drive home in those weather conditions, and he had a brother that lived in Chicago, and those were the days when people didn't make long-distance calls, you know, it was well past dark. We were about ready to go to bed, and the dog went out in the hall and jumped around, and sure enough, within 5 minutes, my dad drove up the driveway.
And this was in a new car, so the dog couldn't have recognized the engine
sound. Yes, indeed. And we've never been able to understand how that happened.
Well, you know, I've got a theory. I've got a theory, but, you know, it's only a theory, and since we don't have the car and the dog to run an experiment, it's never going to be anything but a theory. Probably, I'm guessing, the dog was using more than one cue. I'm sure, as you say, that it could recognize the engine sound of the car, because my dogs can recognize the engine sounds of our cars. But he may also have been recognizing the pattern of your father shifting on the hill. I would suspect, I bet we're talking about a stick-shift
car. Yeah, but this
car
was well in advance. Remember, the hill was only a block long,
mm-hmm.
and his behavior started several minutes before he came home.
Yeah, well, dogs have better hearing than we do. So my best guess is that the dog heard the car and said, you know, that doesn't sound like our car, but, you know, okay, he's shifting there. Okay, he's downshifting. You know, that's got to be him. That's got to be him. My dogs use a bunch of different cues to know when they're going to be taken for a walk. And, you know, the more I try to keep it a secret from them, I can't say when I'm taking the beach, I can't say, let's take the dog to the beach, because then they get hysterical and they get in the way. And but they notice if I change my shoes. They notice if I, you know, go to get their leashes. They notice if I go into the kitchen and get plastic bags for the purpose of picking up after them. And the more I try to do these things and camouflage them in my ordinary behavior so they won't figure it out, the cleverer they get about figuring out the cues. And so I'm saying is that they're different cues that they use. And the shoes is one thing, and the leashes is obviously another, and so forth. So, you know, I can't, you know, there's no way to know for sure, but I will bet that your dog not only knew the sound of your car, but recognized your father's driving style.
No, could have been. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you? I came in a little late. Did you talk about parakeets already?
We didn't talk about parakeets specifically. I did talk a little bit about parakeets in the book, and I have a high regard for parakeets.
Well, my great-grandmother used to tell me stories about her parakeet, Pete, and my mother would, you know, she would verify these stories because my mother lived with her growing up, and they had a parakeet, and Pete would... when my mother played the piano, Pete would dance along the piano, and then he would call my great-grandmother Mama Effie, which is what we all called her, and one day he called her just Effie without the mama on it, and she, of course, wouldn't respond to him. And so he learned that that was not appropriate for him to call her just her first name. And then, but one of the things that I thought was so delightful, and you were talking about I guess it was Celeste, you were talking about your dog waking up the children in the house. And my great-grandmother would say, go wake up Marcia. And he would just fly away, and he would get in there, and he would dance on her chest near her head, and he'd say, Marcia Lynn, time for school. Time for school.
Wow.
And I tell the story, because I just think it's so delightful. I tell the story to people, and they're like, they're that sophisticated. There's no way that you can tell them one command, and then they go and they do a whole different series of things. But everything that I've been told about this bird was that he was just that smart, that you could tell him a particular command, and he would go and carry out these other things.
You know, I completely believe that. I think that is all within the capacity of a number of birds in the parrot family. Now, it may be that Pete was a particularly smart parakeet, but he's not, you know, there are other birds in the parrot family that do that. And one of the things that I discovered in reading about learning about vocal learning, learning to speak and understand signals, is that a lot of animals are much better than we realize at understanding sounds, at learning what they mean, and often they're better at learning what, you know, like this dog who knew 200 different names of toys and things. That dog can't speak. It can't utter 200 different sounds, as far as we can tell, to indicate toys, but they're much better at receptive learning than productive learning.
Mm-hmm.
And parakeets are a bit of an exception because they can also learn to say, Marcia Lynn, time to go to school.
Right.
But there's a parrot who's been described in the scientific literature called Okichiro, who not only repeats lots of phrases, but he also learned to imitate gestures, which is pretty unusual. So he would say, come in, and then he would wave his claw in the air as if he were knocking on a door. And he would make the sound of knocking. He would walk in place, and he would make the sound of footsteps. Mm-hmm. He would say, bye-bye, and he would wave his wing bye-bye, which is, you know, there are lots of parrots who say bye-bye, but the first one I've heard about who actually waves bye-bye.
Well, I just
and,
I thought this whole
so,
thing
so
was
different
very
from your parakeet.
Yeah, well, I think it's so fascinating, and I just think that for people to think that we're so egocentric that we can't, we're the only ones who can learn these complex patterns is just kind of species-centric, I guess. But thank you so much for the show.
Thanks for calling this afternoon. You know, I told my husband the other night, I said, you know, the cat knows the difference between when you are slicing meat and when you're chopping something. Not interested in onions, not interested in fruit, but if you're slicing something with a particular knife, he knows that maybe if he shows up, he could get a little kibble.
Yep, so, this is important news.
Pretty smart.
Thing to learn.
Let's talk with another listener here this afternoon. Let's go next to a caller on line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if there's a school of study or thought about applying rules of animal behavior to humans, because I think we forget too often that we're animals. And I'd really love to read a bunch or even hear what you have to say about people who, for example, can tell a liar from someone who's telling the truth, or, for example, how a con artist works. I'd be curious to know what you have to say about that.
That's really interesting. And, you know, a lot of animals are better than humans at recognizing nonverbal cues. I've read where zookeepers say that if you're having trouble at home and you go to work, you can conceal it from your human coworkers, but you cannot conceal it from the chimpanzees, for example. They know something's wrong. So I think that, you know, there actually might be room to try to learn these kind of skills from animals. I'm not aware of any program to do that. Typically, what people try to do is they try to use methods from human learning to teach animals, and often that doesn't work very well. One of the things that I discovered in doing this research is that we're not very good at teaching things in an effective way, and some of the mistakes that I see scientists make when they're trying to teach animals something is they like to do drills, and animals don't like drills. They like to do tests to establish what they've taught the animals, and animals get really bored with tests, and you can't test them for very long, or they'll get mad and they'll do a bad job on purpose. They don't like educational videos. Usually they will not watch them, even if there are other animals in them. Even if you sit there with them saying, oh, look what he's doing, they don't want to watch a video. Birds don't like to learn from tapes and records. There was an interesting experiment with little zebra finches that were raised in isolation, and they were playing them tapes of songs to see what songs they could learn. And the answer seemed to be that they wouldn't learn any of the songs until they were allowed to push the buttons on the tape recorder themselves. So animals like control. They like to be in charge. And what they really, really like is to see somebody else being taught. And then they're not under pressure to be taught. So if you teach another animal, the animal that's going to learn best is not the animal you're teaching, but the animal that gets to eavesdrop. The other thing that's interesting is that animals don't like to do things that they're not good at in public. So little birds that are practicing bird song, they'll sing so quietly you can't hear them at all. You can just see their beak and throat moving. Kanzi, the bonobo that they taught to use symbols on a board, sometimes he will go away and he'll write sentences on his board by himself. And when the scientists come over to see what he's writing, he'll quickly fold the board up and walk away so they can't see. You know, animals like to have control, and they don't like boring stuff. And I think that if we could take some of these lessons that scientists are gradually learning, that, for example, you know, a blackboard in a classroom is not the best way to teach a chimpanzee. Mm-hmm. The best way is something more like preschool and going for walks. If we could take some of these lessons that we're slowly learning from animals and put them back into human learning, we might be able to learn things ourselves faster and with less rebellion.
Yeah. It sounds like an untapped gold mine for educators.
Yeah, we could learn more and we could be better teachers.
Yep.
Along the way as well. We've used up all the time. It went so quickly. Susan, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Celeste, for having me.
My pleasure. Susan McCarthy has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is co-author of When Elephants Weep. Her new book is Becoming a Tiger, How Baby Animals Learn to Live in the Wild. Becoming a Tiger is published by HarperCollins. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Is Todd with us this afternoon, or Dave?
It's Todd Gleason. Okay. How are you this afternoon,
I'm
by the way?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, busy. It was a busy day at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Started a little early, actually not the trade, of course, but some reports out from USDA this morning. World agricultural supply and demand estimates were out, and there was a crop production report out. Let me go through some quick numbers. USDA now predicting this year's corn crop will be a big one, a record breaker, in fact, at 10.635 billion bushels, the current record at 10.1 billion bushels. So blowing past that big time should this 10.6 crop come to fruition. USDA also predicting a record-sized bean crop at 2.94 billion bushels. Another important number that came out this morning, carryout for the old crop and the beans, now at 105 million bushels. USDA lowered that down from the June estimate of 115. All those things having an impact at the marketplace. You would have thought that the corn might have finished the day lower, but it did not. In fact, it finished higher, as did the wheat futures. July contract at the Board of Trade, 339, the high, the low at 333.5, a settlement price there. Up on the top end of it at 339, 9 cents higher for the day. September contract, 347.5, the high, the low at 338, a settlement at 345.5, up 7.5. December contract in the wheat pit, 360.75 high, low at 351, settlement priced at 358.5, up 7 for the day. And the March futures, 371.5, the high, the low at 363, settled at 369.25, up 6.75. May futures, 3676, the high, the low at 366.5, a settlement price at 373. They were up 6.5 cents. I happened to be listening to Kurt Kimmel speaking with our own Dave Dickey this morning on the opening market report, and he said at 931, they'd be done trading this report. And sure enough, the corn pit finished the day higher despite that 10.6 billion bushel crop. We'll find out what Kurt has to say this afternoon at 6 after the hour. 245, the high for the day in the corn in July contract. The low at 239.5, settled at 244.5. They were up 2.25 on the day. September corn, 248.5, the high, the low at 242. Settled 248, up 1.75. December futures, 254.75, high, low at 249. Settled 254.25, they were up 2 on the day. March contract, 262.25, the high, the low at 256.75. Settled 262, up 2.5 cents in the May corn, 267.75, the high, the low at 262.5. Settled 267.25, up 2.5 cents. July futures in the corn pit now, 271.25, the high, the low at 266.25. Those July 2005 corn contracts settled 2.25 higher at 270.5. And the September, 267, the high, the low at 263, settled 267, up 2 on the day. December futures for next year, 264, the high, the low at 259.5, settled at 263.75. They were up 1.5. I have to admit, I did not listen to Dave live today, but I did listen to him on the web, and you can do that too. It's at WILL.UIUC.edu. Just click on AM and then agriculture. July oats, 136, the high, the low, and the settlement price all across the board, up 2 cents for the day. And the September at 139.25, the high, the low at 135.5, settled 138. They were up 2.75 on the day. From the soy complex now, the nearby beans, July contract, 955, the high, the low at 930, settled 937, off 17 cents. We'll find out why from Kurt Kimmel. August contract, 813, the high, the low at 783. Settled 786. They were down 28. And the September beans, 675, the high, the low at 659. Settled 665.75. They were off 11.25 on the day. Now the November's on the out. Your new crop, 645, the high, the low at 629. Settled 641, down 5.25. in the January. 648, the high, the low at 635, settled 646, down a nickel. March contract, a nickel lower as well. 650, the high and the settlement price, their low at 642. In the May contract in the bean pit, 646, the high, low at 639 and a half, settled 645 and a half for the May beans, 2.5 cents lower. Bean meal now, the nearby July, 327, the high, the low at 311, settled 313, down 170. The August, 286.50, the high, the low at 275, settled 275.50, down 135. And now the July bean oil for the day, 279, the high, the low at 270, settled 270. They were off 118 for the day. And the August oil, 26.90, the high, the low at 26.43, settled 26.57, down 6.70. You know what? That August bean meal contract, I just read that wrong. They were off 13.50 for the day. Now, from the Mercantile Exchange, here are the numbers from Celeste Quinn.
Okay, Todd, let's take a look at livestock prices and where they finished today. Feeder cattle were higher, live cattle lower, and lean hogs mixed. August feeder cattle, 114.05, the high, 112.40, the low, the settlement, 113.55, that up $1. September feeder cattle, 112.40, the high, 110.85, the low, 111.85, the settlement, that up 42.5. October feeder cattle, 109.40, the high, 107.60, the low, 108.90, the settlement, that up 42.5. August live cattle, 84.50, the high, 83.55, the low, 83.67.5, the settlement, that down 62.5. October live cattle, 86.75, the high, 86 even the low, finishing at 86.70, down 25. July lean hog, 79.80 the high, 79.40 the low, 79.45 the settlement, that down 12.5. August, 76.95 the high, 76.07.5 the low, 76.32.5 the settlement, that up 12.5. October, 66.90 the high, 66.05 the low, 66.82.5 the settlement, that up 10. December lean hog, 61.95 the high, 61.30 the low, 61.87.5 the settlement, that down a nickel. July pork bellies, 115.40 the high, 114.50 the low, 115.17.5 the settlement, that up 27.5. And let me just repeat July pork bellies, the high today. I don't know if I misspoke there. 115.40, the high today for July bellies. The Dow currently up 28 points at 10,241. The NASDAQ down 7 at 1939. The S&P 500 up 2 points at 1115.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
David Kindy from San Mateo, California wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, I was on a 767 airliner yesterday.